Welcome to Unwrap with J-Rap. I'm your host, J-Rap. So I have to apologize first off for any sound that you might hear. I am near a train station and near a road, so you might hear some car noises or a train in the background, and I apologize for that. So moving right along, I am going to talk about being on ship, how ship life was for me when I was on a Navy vessel or Navy ship. It's not called a boat, just so everyone knows. The Navy does not like it being referred to as a boat, because a boat is small and a ship is massive. Anyways, so one of the things that I experienced many times was with my MOS, my military occupational specialty, so basically my job. Part of my job was loading and unloading, or the oversight of the loading and unloading of people and personnel and gear, equipment, and vehicles. So whenever a ship would pull into port, there's a team of, we call them red patchers. That was my MOS, was a red patcher. Or what you, longshoremen would be the civilian equivalent. And it was basically the landing support is what we call it. Landing support specialist. It's basically like a landing force that dealt with things coming off of a ship or going on a ship. And also for aircraft as well, and even rail. We do that with trains, but not as much. That's more done on the East Coast, and I've done that, but I did it in Korea, actually. But it's not something we do often. We don't use rail all that often here. Maybe in Europe it probably happens a lot more, but here, not so much. So when we unload and load these ships, basically you have a team of Marines with a corpsman, which is like the medical person. And we basically go out and we are the ones in charge of everything going on or coming off of the ship. And then we work with embarkation specialists. They're the ones that actually have the load plans, and they're the ones that are, they usually make the load plans, and then they kind of have the overall say where things go. Well, other than the ship's captain or some of the shipmates, some of them will have the say on where something goes for sure, because it's their, you know, it's their ship, so they can decide what goes where. But generally we have a load plan and we stick to it. So based on a load plan, let's say you have 10 vehicles going on. Based on the priority of when you're gonna need those vehicles to come off, we load the reverse. Because when you load something on the ship, the last thing in the ship is gonna be the first thing off. Now, you know, that's kind of common sense, but that's how it works. So we load everything based on the load plan, which is prioritized. So the things that are gonna be needed right away obviously have to go on last. The only time that deviates is when either there's certain things that have to go in certain places, like for example, the armed assault vehicles, the AAVs, those have to go on the well deck. They can't go anywhere else. They have to go on the well deck. The LCACs, landing craft air cushion, basically hovercraft, those have to go in a certain place on ship as well, which is well deck, has to go there. Vehicles can go on the well deck. They can go up the ramp on the other floors. It just depends, or decks, not floors. So yes, it's by priority, but it's going to depend on what can go where. And then the other thing that plays into it, hazmat plays into it, and weight, size and weight matters too. So sometimes the ships have a natural pull of either port or starboard, so left or right, just for those of you that didn't know that. So it could have a natural pull to the port side, the left side. So to counter that, we'll put something heavier on the right. So it kind of levels it out how it moves on the water. And that gives the ship's crew an advantage when you can do that. Fuel efficiency, maneuvering. They don't have to set the rudder to constantly be aiming to the right because it naturally pulls to the left, so they have to counter that by pulling to the starboard, to the right. So there's that with loading that has to be taken into consideration. So when we load these things, we load, like I said, containers, gear, vehicles, personnel, so Marines, sailors, sometimes we have soldiers and airmen, but not very often. And then every now and then we have some civilians that are contractors that go with us too. We have to take a lot of things into consideration when we're doing this. Our job is basically to, so we don't actually load the gear or unload the gear, we don't technically touch it. We are the facilitators of it. We're the ones that make sure that the throughput of logistics happen, because otherwise it goes into chaos. And the way that our MOS started was we used to be with engineers. We used to be a part of an engineer team. And when they would go on and storm the beach, the infantry would go first, of course, and the infantry had the engineers with them. And they usually had Bangalores, talking World War II here, by the way, had Bangalores, which were great for blowing up concertina wire, barbed wire, and obstacles that were stopping our forces from going forward on the beach, because that's what we did, landing forces on the beach, and amphibious assault is what we call it. So we'd go from the ocean to the land that way. Well, what ended up happening was there was two things that happened. So the first thing would be they came out, everybody came out there, we stormed the beach, we have a firefight, we establish ourselves on the beach, and the infantry and some of the engineers move forward, and they continue to gain ground and fight. Well, eventually, they have to get resupplied with ammunition, food, medical supplies, things like that, either by coming back and getting it, or by us, or not us, but someone bringing it to them. In most cases, that's how it was. They had vehicles bring supplies that they needed to them, water, food, ammunition, whatever it might be, medical supplies. And then in some cases, prisoners of war, take them back with us to wherever we have a staging area. So our job was to stage the beach so that when these ships came to do the resupply, so you have these boats that come from the ship that drop all the supplies off on the beach. So like I said, there was two things that happened. One thing happened was they went forward, the infantry went forward, a bunch of them got injured, killed, whatever, what have you, or they needed more Marines to go forward. So they would go back, they'd send people back and pull everybody from the beach. So then all these Marines that are supposed to be handling things on the beach, handling the supplies and everything, get pulled off the beach and sent forward as like a reinforcement. Then what happens is the ship would come in to do the resupply and nobody's there to stage it. So everything just gets thrown on the beach. Well, then when the resupply happens, nobody knows where anything is because it's all just a bunch of crap on the beach. That was one scenario one. Scenario two, what happened was same thing. There'd be a combat, people would get messed up, some people die, people get wounded, and a lot of times people get afraid. So when they did come back for a resupply, sometimes they came back to get a resupply. When they came back, they didn't want to go back forward because they feared for their lives, or they, you know, I mean, it's a terrible thing. So they maybe don't want to go back or whatever. So they stay on the beach and act like they are the landing party. So then the stuff comes off the ship and there's, instead of, you know, whatever, however many they need, 30, 40 Marines on the beach setting things up, there's maybe 80 on the beach. And most of them don't know what they're doing because that's not their job. So they're just saying this goes there, that goes there. And they're just same thing as before, but it's maybe organized on the beach, but not in a way that it's supposed to be organized. So wherever we'd put the medical supplies, they might be right next to the ammunition, which is right next to the rations. So rations, medical supplies, and ammunition, and then maybe the fuel next to that. Well, then all it takes is the enemy to hit us with one, something that explodes, you know, some type of artillery or a mortar or something, and all your medical supplies are gone, all your food's gone, all your fuel's gone, all your ammo's gone. Not to mention the explosion from the fuel and the ammunition. So everything would be gone that you would need. That would obviously be like the most terrible thing that could happen. So to prevent that from happening, they gave the landing support Marines, which were used to be called landing support battalion, and before that it was just, I think it was just the landing team or something like that, shore party, something like that. Anyway, so what they did was they gave them patches that were one by one on the helmet and one by three right where the knees are that were red. That's why they call them red patchers. So anybody who had that wasn't able to be pulled off the beach. Anybody who did not have that wasn't allowed to stay on the beach. So that kept the integrity of who is supposed to be organizing everything when the supplies came from the ship. So that's how we became different than everybody else in the Marine Corps, because no one else had patches. And Marine Corps doesn't have that. Army has patches and they have badges and stuff like that. The Marine Corps doesn't have that. We don't do our rank structure that way. We don't do our rank insignias that way for, you know, the camouflage utilities or camis. We don't do that with anything. So the only thing that would be different from that normal thing would be somebody wearing like scuba wings or scuba bubbles, or jump wings for the people that went through airborne school and were parachuters or riggers. They had a device that they wore, and now they have EOD. They wear their explosive ordnance device, the, I don't even know what it's called, pin. And those things are the only things that I can think of that are worn on the uniform, that uniform, the camouflage utilities, camis. Other than that, red patchers have the red patches and nobody else does. So it singles us out in a good way, and sometimes in a bad way now, but back then it was a good thing. And it kept the integrity on the beach so that supplies could get where they need to get, how they need to get. So now that you know the basic history of landing support, I'll go into my time on ship and some of the different things that we did because of my MOS. So with my MOS, like I said, we facilitated the loading and unloading of gear, vehicles, personnel, we call them packs, CAX. And the way that we did it was, like I said, we had a load plan for the gear, and then we have a manifest for personnel. When we loaded personnel, we did it basically last so that we didn't have people in the middle of this whole mix-up of gear going on and vehicles driving on and, you know, AAVs, tracked vehicles going on. You know, the last thing you want is people in the way. So our job is to, like I said, facilitate it. So we basically are, sometimes we were called glorified ground guides. So if you've ever seen traffic, and you know, the traffic cop that's wanding, you know, got the little light flashlight or a wand, and he's telling you to go or stop or whatever, we kind of do that for forklifts, and for gear, vehicles with gear or vehicles going on and off. And we have certain hand and arm signals that we do for different things, for vehicles and for forklifts, so that we can do whatever we need to do, get gear on, take gear off, what have you. So yes, we have that glorified ground guide thing, but then on top of that, we have to get with the embarker and find out where specific gear needs to go, what gear needs to go, and we stage it before anything happens. We stage it at the port itself. That way, when the embarkers, you know, show up to have the ship loaded, or the ship pulls in, because usually this is done way before the ship gets there, and everything's already set up in the order that it needs to go on, meaning that the order that things come off are going on last. So we would set everything up, stage it, usually the night before, sometimes two, three days before. Ship comes in, we go out there, we make sure that everything's safe. That's our job mainly, is to make sure that everything gets on and off, accounted for and safe. And then everything goes on and everything's safe. Then from that point, if we are actually on the deployment, we go on the ship very last, and then we leave port. And then while we're at sea, depending on what kind of ship we're on, if we're on a Navy vessel, we go by the Navy's rules. We have berthing, usually designated just for Marines. We have specific showers we have to use on ship. The Navy is very strict about showers underway. Like, I think it's like 5 minutes or 2 minutes or something like that, when there's a time when you're constrained. And there's no long, like, the Navy doesn't take long showers on ship when you're underway, because there's only so much fresh water. So we basically, you turn on the water, you lather up, or you turn on the water, you get wet, you turn off the water, you lather up, turn on the water, rinse it off, turn off the water, dry off, get out. It's pretty much how it goes. So I think it's like 2 minutes or something like that. I can't remember, but it was pretty awful, to be honest. Not used to that. And you eventually do get used to that, but it just wasn't fun. The berthing, we had coffin racks, is what they call it. It looks like a coffin. I felt really bad for anybody that was a little bit bigger than me. I'm about 5'9 and a half, and people that are about 6 foot and taller barely fit in that thing, or don't fit in that thing. So they have to bend their knees just to fit in there. It's about, 2 feet wide and about 2 feet tall. So you don't have a lot of room in there. Like, if you were to get scared of something in the middle of the night or something, you sit up really fast, you're smacking your head, unless you're on the top bunk. If you're on the top one, then you might be lucky there's nothing above you. And then in some cases, there's pipes above you, so it might be worse. I got lucky. I got the second rack. So there's a rack that's just a little bit above the ground, like 6 inches above the ground. That sucks, because you have to pretty much lay down on the floor and then roll in. At least I thought so. Then there's the second level, which is what I had. And it's pretty much a little bit about the waist, so you can just roll right in. The one above that is about shoulder height, maybe a little higher. So you have to climb up. When the ship is underway and you hit some pretty big swells, the ship is swaying back and forth. If you're on the top rack, then you're getting rocked quite a bit. And they have these little straps that go on by your feet, kind of, about probably where your shins are, and then up where your shoulders are, somewhere around there. And that's basically just to catch you so you don't fall out of your rack, because that will happen if it sways enough. One of the things we had a TV set up. We had got a cargo strap and strapped it up by one of the racks so we could actually watch TV. I couldn't see it from my rack. I had to get out and go, you know, sit down next to, put my back to another rack and sit on the floor, and then I could watch the TV. Well, it was at night, probably like, I don't know, 11, 12, maybe 1 o'clock in the morning. We were hitting, I think, 6 to 8 foot swells. We were on a pretty small ship in comparison. So it's still a Navy vessel, still a ship. So it's still big, but it was one of the smaller ones. It's a LSD, landing dock ship, which is funny. It should be LDS, but it's LSD. Anyway, so we hit 6 to 8 foot swells and this TV fell off the rack and landed in on the bottom in that first rack, the bottom rack. Luckily there was nobody there because it landed straight in there. And then we realized no more strapping the TV up. I thought it was cool to be on ship, especially when we hit those swells, because it's like being rocked like a baby to sleep. I got to sleep so fast when we were underway. And then you get your sea legs too. That's what they call it, your sea legs. When you're underway on ship and you hit some pretty big swells, the ship's constantly moving anyway, you know, left, right, left, right. And when you walk down the halls, sometimes the halls, like, they're going sideways. I mean, the floor, because the whole ship is moving. And you'll see people, like, in, you know, in like movies or cartoons where people go hit the wall and then they hit the other wall. Or like in a cartoon, the table will slide across and then it'll slide back. Well, that actually does happen. I mean, almost everything is bolted down on ship because of that. But people have to walk up and down it. And you can always tell who is new on ship or who doesn't have their sea legs, because they're the ones ping-ponging down the hallway. I think within 24 to 48 hours, I got my sea legs. And that was, I was fine after that. I was actually almost running up and down the halls by then without having to really compensate, just because you get used to it. Anyway, so I liked being on ship. It was fun. Longest time I think we were underway was close to a month, around a month. And you're talking nothing for hundreds of miles, maybe thousands, I don't know. A long ways away from anything except buoys. There's buoys out there. And the buoys, I guess, are, they help navigate or something. I have no idea. I just know that we saw them every now and then. And a short little story I'll tell about that. So we were on ship. We were coming back from, I don't remember where, Thailand or Philippines or something, on a Navy ship. And we were with a fleet. So we had a submarine, which we never saw the whole time we were there. Didn't even know it was with us. We were told later that it was with us. We had some destroyers, some battleships, and, you know, we basically a normal fleet. We had everything, I think, except for an aircraft carrier. We might have had that too. I don't even know. We had Coast Guard with us as well. They did some training with us, which was kind of cool. Anyway, so we're going down from one place to another underway, and we get a man overboard, but it's not a drill, actual man overboard. So we're like, okay. So everybody has to go to their rooms, to their berthing areas, and everybody has to get inside their rack. And then you have specific people that were designated prior to that to go through, and they make sure that every single person in there, underneath them, they're in their, you know, platoon or squad or whatever, make sure that they were in the rack, or if they weren't in the rack, that they were accounted for elsewhere. Like, you have people that work in the armory, you have people that work in the galley, which is like the basically the kitchen, which I work in the officer's mess, which is awesome. I'll talk about that a little later. So they get accountability, and if there's somebody missing, they do the accountability again. Now, we'd done one man overboard drill before, and it was basically the same thing, except we had more people that were not in their racks because they had responsibilities they had to do at that time during the drill. But when the actual man overboard happened, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning or something like that. It was really late. So most of the people were in bed sleeping. And the only people that weren't really were the ship's crew, the people that worked in the engine rooms, you know, the people that actually worked on the ship and kept the ship running. So those people were accounted for, but not in their racks. And then the rest of the Marines were, and sailors were in their racks. So the actual man overboard happens and we get woken up. Nobody knows why. We thought it was a drill. And then they told us this is not a drill. Somebody's possibly missing. We don't know where they're at. So they do this two times, three times, just to make sure that, you know, somebody wasn't like sneaking off with one of the females and making out with them somewhere, or I don't know, maybe there were two dudes, I don't know, who knows. They have to make sure that, you know, somebody's not, maybe they're taking a dump, you know, so they have to find where this person might be. Well, unfortunately, there was one missing, and it was a sailor. So So what had happened was this sailor was on post. He was on what we call fire watch. He was on post and his job is to make sure that everything's secure on whatever area he was in and keep his eye out, you know, looking out in the water as well. So apparently his, I don't know if it was like his ex-wife or ex-girlfriend or something happened with his woman and he was depressed and upset. So what he did was he went to the armory, turned in his weapon, and then instead of waking up the next person or getting that person, he just jumped off the ship, which is freaking crazy to jump off of a ship in the middle of the night. But I guess that, you know, he wanted to kill himself. So he jumps off to end his life and we are, I don't even know how many. We don't know when he jumped off. We know about when because he had a post for like 4 hours or 6 hours. So it was somewhere between, you know, one time and another. And they know when he turned in his weapon, but he never went and got the other person. So I don't know how that went down exactly, but they had like a 4 hour window of when this guy could have jumped off ship. And they didn't know he jumped off, obviously. They thought maybe he fell off or something happened. So we called out to the fleet, our ship, called out to the rest of the fleet to let them know that we had a man overboard and to do what they can to see if they can find this guy. Well, there was another ship. I don't know if it was in our fleet or another fleet. I don't remember. But what I do remember though is that one of the ships, either with our fleet or another fleet, found this guy. So this guy had jumped off ship to kill himself. And I don't know how long he swam for, but he found a buoy. And then he hung on to that buoy for like a 28-hour period or 32-hour period, something like that. It was a long, he was there all day. And I think they found him at night or just before the sun went down. I don't remember. But we found out from that ship telling our ship that they had found him. So, of course, everybody was happy that this guy didn't die. And then that's how we found out the story. That this guy wanted to end his life. He jumped off ship and found a buoy. So all of us said, you can't say there's not a God. This guy, like I said, jumped out in the middle of nowhere in the ocean and found a buoy. Now, if you've ever been out at sea like we were, it could be days before you see a buoy. Now the Navy, the pilot of the ship, the captain or whoever is commanding the ship or whoever can see in front of us, however they do that, I'm sure that they can see the buoys. But a normal person, when we were looking out, I remember for 30, 40 minutes on ship going in whatever direction we were going in and not seeing anything. For that whole 30 minutes, I was staring out at this blue ocean. All I saw is ocean. That's it. There's nothing else out there. So for a person to swim, you'd have to swim a long ways to find a buoy. So again, we pretty much all, you know, even people who don't necessarily believe there's a God or agnostic or whatever, they came to terms with it like, okay, that's, what are the chances of a person swimming in this vast open waters and finding a buoy? I don't know what the percentage is on that, but I would bet that it's probably very slim. Talking less than 1% of a chance that you would find a buoy out there. So he either jumped off near a buoy or he floated or swam near a buoy and found it. I don't know, but either way, he got on a buoy and he was on this buoy. So he got dehydrated. He almost died of exposure. So basically the sun and not having water. And they found him and He ended up being okay. This is just crazy to know that somebody would be that upset with their life that they would jump off ship. What I really didn't understand was he had a rifle. And normally I would say, you know, he wanted to end his life. That's the way to do it because there's pretty much no chance of him coming back from that. But to jump out in the ocean, like I understand people have a reluctancy to want to die. Like people with even with suicidal ideology or suicidal thoughts or tendencies, there's people that have those thoughts and they don't actually go through with it all the way. Like the people that, you know, have attempted suicide in some way and didn't die. Sometimes it's for attention, as we know. And then sometimes it's because they didn't really want to die, so they didn't foolproof their killing themselves, if you catch what I'm saying. So like person that hangs himself from a spot that they could possibly climb up something if they didn't really want to hang, you know, or trying to drown yourself. Like in a pool, you're not gonna let yourself drown in a pool. You're gonna go to the side and get out and be like, what was I just thinking? But this guy was a sailor, and I'm assuming he'd been on ship before, out underway before. And if he hadn't, he's already figured out by being on post or by being on ship already, there's no coming back from jumping off. Like you jump off in this vast ocean, you could get eaten by a shark. You could die of, you know, whatever, the cold. You could die of just drowning. Like that would be terrible because you cramp up, you are no longer able to keep yourself afloat, and then you drown. Or you're lucky and, you know, you've done training that Marines do. I'm sure the Navy does too, where you have a tactic where you're able to get, you know, help yourself float for a longer period of time. But at some point, you're going to die of something out there, whether it's exposure, dehydration, and you pass out and then you drown. You get cramped up and you fall down and you drown, or something attacks you and eats you. I mean, those are things that are normally or what's going to happen. This guy found a freaking buoy. So, and I don't think the chances of him finding a buoy and are like looking and seeing a buoy and then jumping, thinking, you know, if I change my mind, there's a buoy right there. That's so slim. And it's like almost not going to happen. More chances than he did if he just jumped off and then found a buoy. But still, the chances are so slim. Anyway, it was crazy. That was a story that I had to tell because it was just crazy. Well, this concludes this part. I have to break it down because otherwise it would be, I think, like an hour and a half or 2 hours or something like that. It's a very long recording that I did. So I'm breaking it into a couple different pieces. Hopefully you guys are okay with that. I hope that you guys enjoyed. Thank you for your support. Until next time.